Welcome to the next session of How Writers Write Poetry. For this session, we will be discussing form and content, specifically the sound of a poem, the shape of a poem, how sound can inform shape and generate new work. This is one of those thorny issues in poetry that is, for me, absolutely thrilling and challenging to think about, how form can be that great liberation. It may seem from the outside as a prison house, but in fact, for the truly imaginative, it becomes a way to find material, find those secret depths in the soul that maybe are closed off to you. For this session, we'll begin with Mary Jo Bang, who is the author of 6 books of poems, most recently The Last 2 Seconds, as well as a translation of Dante's Inferno. She's received numerous honors and awards for her work, including fellowships from the Guggenheim Foundation and the Bellagio Foundation, a Hodder Fellowship from Princeton University. She's the former editor of the Boston Review and currently is a professor at Washington University in St. Louis.
So next we're going to hear from Carol Light, who received MFA from University of Washington, where she was awarded the Academy of American Poets Prize. She also received the Robert H. Winner Award from the Poetry Society of America in 2013 and an award from Artists Trust in 2012. Her first book is Heaven from Steam. And lastly, we're going to close out with Carl Phillips, the author of 12 books of poetry, including most recently Silver Chest and Double Shadow, which won the Los Angeles Times Book Prize. He's been awarded many honors, including the Kingsley Tufts Poetry Award, the Tom Gunn Award for Gay Male Poetry, and he was named a chancellor for the Academy of American Poets in 2006. So first we're going to have Mary Jo Bang talking about creating a soundscape for a poem and how sound creates meaning. Then we'll have Carol Light, who will employ those same elements in speaking about how to create a sort of sound cloud, a word cloud of sounds. And then we'll go on to Carl Phillips, who will speak about form as an expressive element in poetry. And we hope that moving from one to the next, you'll see the different ways of employing shape and sound in poetry.
I'm Mary Jo Bang. I'm going to talk today about sound and music in poetry. There's always been sound. Of course, every time we say a word, the word has sound. But, of course, when we read poetry, the word is on the page, so theoretically it doesn't have any sound, except the fact is that we hear it, even though it's not being said out loud. In our mind, we imagine it. And I think that sometimes poets fail to understand that that sound is going to be communicated, whether they're in the room reading it or not. And I'd like to look at a couple of poems where sound is so integral that you can't ignore it, and it's there for a very particular reason, and it carries an expressive weight. The fact is that all sound carries an expressive weight, and so poets who know that and understand it and can measure the weight of that sound can use it in order to communicate. So, and communicate in and of itself, apart from what the words say, the content of the poem. So I'm going to start with a poem that has a lot of sound and has a lot of sonic momentum. It's Allen Ginsberg's Howl. I'll just read a couple of lines from the beginning of it. I saw the best minds of my generation destroyed by madness, starving, hysterical, naked, dragging themselves through the Negro streets at dawn looking for an angry fix, angel-headed hipsters burning for the ancient heavenly connection to the starry dynamo in the machinery of night whose poverty and tatters and hollow-eyed and high sat up smoking in the supernatural darkness of cold water flats floating across the tops of cities contemplating jazz, etc. So you can hear both the kind of push of speech of the ongoing sentence, the sentence that refuses to stop, but there's also kinds of repetition that we find in very traditional poems like alliteration. So we have the doubling of the consonants, hollow-eyed and high, We have internal rhymes. We have assonance, the repetition of vowel sounds. And in this case, there are so many sounds that they're bound to be repetitions. So it carries with it a kind of music, right? A very jumbled music of lots of sounds. The sounds keep going forward, and they take you just like a kind of manic rant. And that's, of course, what Ginsberg is creating here. So I'm going to look at another poem that is actually by someone who influenced Ginsberg, and that's Walt Whitman. And Whitman's most famous poem, of course, is Leaves of Grass. And so this is part two of Leaves of Grass. The smoke of my own breath echoes, ripples, buzzed, whispers, love root, silk thread, crotch, and vine, my respiration and inspiration. The beating of my heart, the passing of blood and air through my lungs, the sniff of green leaves and dry leaves, and of the shore and dark colored sea rocks and of hay in the barn, the sound of the belched words of my voice, words loosed to the eddies of the wind. Totally different tone, and yet the same kind of inclusiveness, but here it's more a kind of auricular voice, a voice that is trying to include everything in it. And Whitman also uses a device called anaphora, where the beginning of the line repeats either a word or a phrase. So I'm going to jump down a little bit. Have you reckoned 1,000 acres much? Have you reckoned the earth much? Have you practiced so long to learn to read? Have you felt so proud to get at the meaning of poems? Stop this day and night with me, and you shall possess the origin of all poems. You shall possess the good of the earth and sun. There are millions of suns left. You shall no longer take things at second or third hand, nor look through the eyes of the dead, nor feed on the specter in books. You shall not look through my eyes either, nor take things from me. You shall listen to all sides and filter them from yourself. So you shall possess, you shall no longer, you shall not look, you shall listen to all sides. It also becomes very biblical. So you have a kind of, preacher who's telling you, but this preacher is subverting the usual Christian idea of God being at the helm, and instead you are at the helm. It's on you, and you and the poet are one, and so that there's a kind of both responsibility and freedom that comes in that. Okay, so we've looked at those two poems, and we've seen how sound is working in both differently and yet the same. The same in that it's carrying something with it. It's carrying meaning and it's carrying tone. So I'm going to look at another poem now that uses a lot of sound and tonally is very, very different. And it's a poem by Gerard Manley Hopkins. Hopkins was a Jesuit priest and he wrote a series of sonnets that chronicled a kind of crisis of faith and what probably today we'd call a clinical depression. So this one has been titled Carrion Comfort. Not, I'll not carrion comfort, despair, nor feast on thee, nor untwist, slack they may be, these last strands of man in me, or most weary cry, I can no more, I can something, hope, wish day come, not choose not to be, but ah, but oh, thou terrible, why wouldst thou root on me, thy ring world, right foot rock, lay a lion limb against me, scan with darksome, devouring eyes my bruised bones and fan, oh, in terms of tempest, me heap there, me frantic to avoid thee and flee. Now, this is such a tangled skein of sound that it's hard to unpack it, listening to it for the first time, but the best way to read it is to read it out loud and to see that there's an expressive element in it, and that is the excess. And this excess is an excess of feelings. And so how would one, if one were in the depths of despair, how would you ever communicate despair except by heightening the mood of the poem? And in doing that, this is out of the ordinary. And I think all three of these poems that we've looked at so far are out of the ordinary. And they're using sound. It's not what they say. It's the sound they're using that makes them outside of normal discourse. Now, that's not to say that a poem can't use normal speech, colloquial speech, and still have something very particular about it. And now you could say, I know, but what about content? Well, content is always suggestion. So there's suggestion in everything that's said. It's up to us to make meaning out of what's being said. So we can think about the fact that, look at this language, how we listen to it all the time and we never pay attention to the fact that it is language. We never pay attention to the fact that we're all tied together. I mean, isn't that what lyric poetry is? It's the thread that ties us together as human beings. The poem is a social space on which we're sharing certain common elements. And some of them are very serious and have a lot of gravity. Others, not so much. The Owl and the Pussycat went to sea in a beautiful pea-green boat. That, too, is a poem. You can say, well, that's not very grave, and so that poem is for children. Well, maybe. Maybe if we examine the words of that and think about it, we'll actually find some meaning in that one, too. But the words are suggestions. The words are associative. The associations, some associations have taken place in the mind of the poet, but others will take place in the mind of the reader. There are actually studies that show that when we read certain words that have a sensory association, that the parts of our brain that are activated have to do with how it is to experience those in real time. For instance, they showed people who were wired to an MRI machine, they showed them the phrase, the suede glove. And that part of the brain that experiences texture lit up. So we don't even know that that's happening, but when we read the suede glove, our mind is saying, what is it like? What is suede like? And then it's remembering times that we've touched things. So the sound of that, the suede glove, on the page, again, which is theoretically silent, is actually making us experience suede-ness. And that is a sound. So every sound that we're experiencing in a poem, our brain is lighting up all over the place. And again, one can use that to direct where you want people's brains to light up. Now, when there is no cultivation or curating of the sound of a poem, some poets want to privilege what's being said over how it's being said. But the fact is that there is always that element of how it's being said. So you might want to think about how it's being said in terms of sound, how it's being said in terms of those sensory words. The great critic Marjorie Perloff has a term called the formal fallacy. And what she refers to with that is the idea that it's a poem just because the lines are broken. And that's a fallacy. That doesn't make it a poem. Well, it does. It makes it a poem because part of our experience of poemness is that it has broken lines. But it doesn't necessarily make it a good poem. Or it doesn't make it a poem that realizes the poet's ambitions for the poem. And I think that if we begin to be sensitized to sound and what it does, we have a better chance of realizing those ambitions and of communicating something in a poem, in the format of a poem. What we communicate is still completely open and has a lot of potential. But the attention to sound, the attention to repetition of sounds, which is what music is and which is what poetry is, can be a tremendous asset to the poem.
Another way into a poem is through sound. So maybe I'm walking down the stairs from the shower, and
I get the tooth of a line. Ambition bit her. Ambition bit her. I like it because bit is inside ambition. And then I start going off on a riff on that. So bitter, what else is an ambition? What else does it call to? Amble, amber. I write a string of words. And I can show you just a little bit of a notebook. This is really a word cloud. This is truly how I might begin. I don't want my mind to go straight at this idea of ambition bit her. I want to play with the sound for a while and see where else it might lead me. And so I create a nest of words that go from sound eventually to sense, but it's a long process. So ambition, bitter, I'm just going to read you a list of words. Turbine, bourbon, conifer, timber, frond, friend, ten, trend, render, derma, pander, drama, murder, mudra, mind, M-I-N-E-D, mind with M-I-N-D, rise, ruse, nick, knuckle, amble, back, want, haunt, wet, not, jaundice. Truly, this was a list of words that started a poem for me. And the way it works is that I write down a few words that just pop into my mind, and then I try to associate by sound, not make a story out of it, resisting the temptation to make a narrative out of it and just go with the sounds because they're stranger and it's more fun. And it takes longer. It takes longer to get to making sense. But then I'd start to play the words off of one another. So bitter ambition, ambition bit her. How is injury kin to ambition? Is envy the offspring of injury? Venn diagram. What she wants haunts. Under purple derma lurks umbrage. This is a sequence that came directly out of this list. I love the sound of it. What does it mean? I'm not sure. But by this time, I think I might be onto something. I might be moving my way toward a poem. Dickinson, Emily Dickinson, tells us, tell all the truth, but tell it slant. Success in circuit lies. That is the method for this kind of making of a poem, is not going directly at the idea, but walking all the way around it. What can I discover by coming into closer contact with it before making a judgment? This might be what Keats would call negative capability, you know, existing in uncertainty without any, can't remember how he describes the irritable, maybe, reaching after fact and reason. So I'm not reaching after fact and reason, I'm reaching for sound at this point. And there are methods to do this. And, you know, rhyme is a method. It's a method that's been employed for centuries. It's a method that in some ways has fallen out of favor, is seen as too manipulative. There aren't that many choices in English, really, for rhyme, so they become predictable. But there are ways that you can make that sonic boom happen and create those echoes and have that cascade of sounds in a poem without going to direct rhyme. One of the ways you can do this is to take a linguistics class in college and figure out which sounds are consonant pairs in particular. So you can echo on the vowel, and that's slant rhyme, and that's, everybody does that, that's fine. That's good. It gives you more choices too. But you can make more exact rhymes without looking like you're making exact rhymes and still get the echoes. And that would be by figuring out which consonants come from the same places in the mouth. And a linguistics course will tell you which those are. But you can figure them out yourself by trying to make the sound rather than the letter. So D's and T's, duh, tuh. Your tongue does the same thing against the teeth. Fricatives, the F's and the V's. They're voiced and unvoiced consonants. The nasals, M's and N's, go together. G's and K sounds or hard C's go together. J and CH, J and CH, the labials, P's and B's, the liquids, L's and R's. And so you can get sounds that are more exact rhymes just by playing with these consonant pairs. For example, favor, having a favor, rather than rhyming on savor, you can rhyme on safer. So the F and the V would echo one another there. Jelly and cherry, are a good rhyme because the L's and R's are both liquids, and the J and the CH really come from the same place in the mouth. Juggle and chuckle, the G's and the K sounds, the J and the CH sound, banter and pander. You know, this is a way to generate your list of words, too, when you're working on that word cloud. Butter and puddle are another good example. Another way I like to play with them is rhyme reversals. So a word that starts out, maybe a two-syllable word, banter becomes turban, bag becomes gab, chimp. It's pretty close to pinch if you go backwards, cinch and chintz and perch and chirp and fear and reef and leaf and feel and cheer and reach. It's generative. It gets energy moving around. It's kind of exciting to play with. How you get to sense is a longer process. Another way to do it is with what I like to call cascading rhyme, or I've heard called cascading rhyme, where you can move from sometimes a two-syllable or a three-syllable word and just pick up one of the syllables, not necessarily the one that gets the stress in the word. So shipwreck might get you to recreate. So the rec goes to rec. Recreate gets you to creation, which might get you to ration. Sincere to serious to an estuary. Arable, ballast. Javelin to linger, to girlish, to relished, to shudder, to tarnish. So these are ways to help generate that word cloud. And then the mind begins to do what minds can do. Our minds are good at making associations, at making connections, at trying to make sense of the world. And metaphors come out of this, as well as really beautiful, swollen, sort of hard to pronounce well, blooms of sound. I'm making bad metaphors here now trying to describe it. But I thought I would try to show you how that went from a one-liner that maybe came out of my observations, ambition bit her, to the word cloud, which I've given you in my method, to a poem that's in process that I've been working on for the last couple of months, because in some ways it's a little bit meditative and tricky, but it comes from all these sounds, and I thought I would end with just reading a part of that, and I've called it Venn Diagram. Ambition bit her, what she wants haunts. What atom is it? Doesn't matter. It's appetite that's wet. The jury is in on injury. It's thin skin sentenced to a kind of jaundiced justice. Mustard plaster suggested. Bruise easily? Try arnica. Try mudras. Shaded under purpled derma lurks umbrage. Rue, a ruse, is shunned. And shuns, teeth, nick, knuckles, self-inflicted, envy's engine, chicken, egg, no sphere, this chicken is elliptical, this diagram begins with eggs for orbit's sake, for a universe that hatches grudges, centrifugal force is pseudo, false, at the intersection of union and logic lives then. The path of inertia, merry-go-rounds again. What ekes out is frequent and fugitive. Ambition, injury, umbrage, rue. Not one of envy's lovers has the oomph to be true. That's where I am with the poem right now. I don't know if it's done or not, but that's my method. I recommend it.
Hi, I'm Carl Phillips, and I'm going to talk a bit about how poems, why they look the way they do, and what that has to do with what they're talking about, and with how they end, or sort of don't end. And I thought I'd look at two poems. One is a poem by Stephanie Marlis called Chinese Bowls, and the other one is Dusting by Rita Dove. If you look at this poem, Chinese Bowls, the first thing, just to look at it on the page, is it kind of looks messy, not neat. The lines are all very different lengths, and It's all a sort of one blobby stanza, you could say. The kind of thing that I used to really resist writing. I find that most of my students, and I used to do this too, there's a preference for writing like in couplets. They're all about the same length, or neat little tercets. And there's something appealing about that, the way they look formally well-dressed. And I think that can sometimes make us think that the poem is succeeding more than it actually may be. At least I found that in my own experience. So when I first looked at this Chinese Bowls poem, I hadn't written a poem that looked like this. And I thought that there must be, I like to think there has to be a reason why every poem looks the way it does, and that a poem isn't finished until it's found its actual form. So first, I think I'll read the poem. And that's a start. Chinese Bowls. Butter melting on the knife at breakfast. A deer by the stone wall makes no sound. Eliot sleeping. But things without harmony? In Virgil's Georgics, the wonder is in things unlike the muscled oxen and the delicate bells and fruit of the field. For the ancients, all unlikely things joined in the stars. The goddesses charted among the bears and snakes. And don't things come to harmony? As when you judge someone by how she dresses or keeps house, and then come to see you are alike. I have been going around memories, climbing a flight of stairs from the city street into the quiet disorder of your apartment, your clothes, books, the Chinese bowl you drank from, things that come to likeness. So the bear, the bull, the dog, starlight. So a child at the zoo asks, if she came back, would she be a zebra, a tiger? That poem seems crazy to me, and moves from this domestic scene, butter on a knife, a deer maybe seen through the window, some guy sleeping, we don't know who this guy is, Virgil's Georgics, Greek star patterns, somebody has a memory of some stuff in somebody else's apartment. And then this girl, nameless, asks if she came back, would she be a zebra or a tiger? I think that one of the points of this poem is that Marlis wants to talk about how everything seems to find a kind of harmony, even if at first it doesn't seem to, these things seem to be unlike. I think that's a reason for opening with butter, the deer, and Eliot, whom we never get to know, sleeping. But then she asks, things without harmony? And there starts to be a pattern in this poem that doesn't seem to have any pattern. I've noticed that she asks in line 3, but things without harmony. A few lines later, she talks about, for the ancients, all unlikely things joined in the stars. A couple lines after that, don't things come to harmony? A couple of lines after that, that moment when you come to see you are like this person that before you didn't think you had anything in common with. And towards the end, things that come to likeness, she says, having listed the things that she remembers in someone's apartment. They're random, but they come together under the umbrella, I suppose, of memory. And it starts to be the case that in this poem, each thing is actually groupable in some way that makes sense. Eliot sleeping may seem a random person, but he could be sleeping next to the window through which a deer is seen. Meanwhile, somebody is eating breakfast and looking at this deer. Fine. Things that aren't alike, like oxen and bells and fruit, come together, it turns out, in Virgil's Georgics. Things like the stars are all the same, but the things that they join are incongruous. The bear, various goddesses, Orion. So my point is that this is a poem that wants to corral. It's talking about how information can be grouped in unlikely ways. And it wants to, I think, become a form that corrals lines that seem as if they shouldn't belong together. So they don't have a neatness. They don't all have the same line length. They don't have, you could say that there's a lot of associative leaping that we leap very randomly from a domestic scene to the Georgics, but we slowly see that these things have something in common with each other. And likewise, there are disparate types of grammatical moods. We have the interrogative, we have fragments, incomplete sentences, we have regular declarative sentences. All these things are brought together, and you could say, well, why one stanza? Because the fact of one's stanzedness, if that's a phrase, makes an argument for how everything belongs in the same room, remembering that stanza means room. And we might not normally group these things together, but in a poem that wants to talk about how unlikely things can be grouped together and turn out to have a kind of harmony, it makes sense for the form to bring unlikely looking lines that look very different and grammatical moods and imagery as well, all into the same stanza and have it just sit there like that. The initial reaction looking at it is to say this poem doesn't really seem to have a shape. And by the end, I think anyway, that it has the only shape it can have. It's 16 lines long. It could have been divided into 8 couplets, for example. But that would have a kind of neatness, orderliness, that isn't exactly what this poem is talking about. It's talking about how things can come into maybe a kind of neatness, but they don't have to necessarily look neat when they're together at first. And the form itself reflects that. Even that weird question at the end. So a child at the zoo asks, if she came back, would she be a zebra, a tiger? It seems to have no place in this poem at first. And then there's this idea, I don't know how we get to the child at the zoo, but how it ties in with the rest of the poem, we could say, is the zebra and the tiger. We have had bears and snakes as constellations earlier, but also a zebra and a tiger are two things that are very unlike each other. They're not even in the same, well, they're both mammals, but one's a cat, one's an equine creature. So those are unlike things, and at the same time, they come together under the umbrella, again, of a zoo. So a zoo itself becomes like Virgil's Georgics, or like memory, or like imagination. It's a way of grouping things that don't have a likeness at first. But to this girl, who's imagining the idea of coming back as another animal, they get joined suddenly, just as they're joinable under the umbrella, I keep saying, rubric of a zoo. So, to me, this is a poem that has the only form it can have. On the other hand, if we look at Rita Dove's poem, Dusting, this is another poem that doesn't exactly have neatness to it. Let's see it again. It's 5 stanzas. And although it sort of stays within a kind of narrow column, and so it doesn't, it's nothing wildly ranging in the line length, it has very irregular length stanzas. The first one is 7 lines, the second one's 9, then there's a 12-line stanza, then 8, and then a stanza that's just not only one line, but one word. But here, so you could at first say, is that just random? But no, not if it's a successful poem. It shouldn't be random. And this poem seems one that's more, as we'll see, I'll read it in a minute, it's more about the act of memory. And it wants to, I think, enact how it feels to just barely be able to remember something and as you're doing something else. And that moment, that magical moment when it comes to you, when you stop trying. So here it is, Dusting. Every day a wilderness, no shade in sight. Beulah patient among knickknacks. The solarium a rage of light, a grain storm as her gray cloth brings dark wood to life. Under her hand, scrolls and crests gleam darker still. What was his name? That silly boy, the fair with the rifle booth, and his kiss, and the clear bowl with one bright fish, rippling wound. Not Michael, something finer. Each dust stroke, a deep breath, and the canary in bloom. Wavery memory. Home from a dance, the front door blown open and the parlor in snow. She rushed the bowl to the stove, watched as the locket of ice dissolved and he swam free. That was years before Father gave her up with her name. Years before her name grew to mean promise, then desert in peace. Long before the shadow and sun's accomplice, the tree. Maurice. It's a thrilling moment to me, that moment when she remembers the name Maurice, but how she gets there is, to me, just as thrilling. First of all, looking at stanzas, this poem seems to proceed in the way that we think of stanzas proceeding. Again, this idea of a stanza being a room, and we usually go into one room to do a particular thing. That's the idea, anyway. You eat in the dining room, then you leave it, because now you're ready to live, and you hang out in the living room, or you go to the TV room. And likewise, it seems to me there should be a reason for departing from one stanza and going to the next one. So this opening stanza basically sets the scene of Beulah dusting things. We see there's a solarium. She's got a gray cloth. Fine. And then the next stanza, so that's an exterior scene, you could say. Then the next stanza moves us into the interior of her mind. While she's doing this outside thing, dusting, she's starting to think about some guy at the fair, wonders what his name was one time. And then you could say, why leave to the third stanza? Because in the third stanza, she starts to narrow things down. She's not just thinking about who was that silly boy, but now she's trying to come up with a name. She starts with one, not Michael, something else. And that leads her to think back to the time period of this fish that she brought back in a bowl and unfroze the ice so the fish could swim free. That's one memory. Then she moves forward from that memory, but still in the past, the time when she got married, when her father gave her up with her name. And in the course of all that, when she stopped thinking about the name, actually, she's now thinking about the years that have gone by in terms of marriage and her name changed from meaning promise to desert in peace. And there apparently was a shadow and the sun's accomplice, the tree. And at that moment, kind of almost when we've forgotten she's trying to remember anyone's name, there's this name, Maurice. What I like about this poem is how, well, first of all, so that's the explanation for why it moved from one stanza to another. Each of these stanzas is a phase in her thinking, of her grappling towards trying to remember something. And just as the mind really works, I think, we're rarely thinking about one thing. So while she's thinking about the name of somebody, she also starts to think about having gotten married one time, about her father. Things blur. But somewhere in there, the thing she started looking for emerges, this name. But the other thing that ties these stanzas together is sound. And that also turns out to be the kind of trick of how she gets to the actual name that she was trying to remember. The first stanza is tied together basically with two rhymes, the sound A and the sound I. So every day, a wilderness, no shade in sight. Beulah patient among knickknacks, the solarium a rage of light. So we have day, sight, patient, rage, grain, light, gray, and life. That stanza is locked in with these two rhymes. And then it's let go of. That's another way in which she seems to decide to move on to the next stanza. We have a new set of rhymes in the second stanza. Scrolls will turn out to rhyme with bowl, several lines down. Gleam, a couple lines from that, we get name, which I count that as a rhyme. And further down, we have booth, which kind of rhymes, does rhyme, with wound. You've got that ooh sound. So, again, this is tied together with rhymes, but they're farther away from each other than the ones that dominated the first stanza. Moving on to the third stanza, there's a rhyme almost immediately. Michael and finer rhyme to me. A couple lines down, bloom, home. door, and parlor. And you can see these rhymes are now right next to each other. So they were rhymes sort of near each other in the first stanza, farther from each other in the second. Then they start to become much nearer in the third, almost as if rhyme and its proximity to another rhyming word is another way of tracking how memory is working. And as she gets closer to memory, the rhymes start to come together for her. Still in stanza three, we have snow, bowl, stove, watched and locket. And the stanza ends with two rhymes at the end of their lines, he and free. Finally, we go into this fourth stanza, and here there's kind of some, I guess it's even more proximity, but if two words, when they rhyme, you could say those are close, the closest you can get is to repeat the exact same word. So before rhymes with before. In fact, it's an exact replica of it in stanza four. And name, and then right beneath it is the word name again. So we start to have the, again, sound getting closer and closer, and then an exact replica of itself. And then there's a little bit of math, I suppose. Promise and peace, they sort of rhyme with the sound, the S sound. They don't rhyme vocalically. Is that a word? Yeah, I think it will be. But we have promise, peace, and in the final line of that stanza, accomplice and tree. If this could be math, you could say that accomplice plus tree equals Maurice. You can also see how desert and peace in that stanza is going to be a rhyme for Maurice. So she's stumbled upon the sound. She stumbled upon the sound of S and E in promise and in peace and in accomplice and in tree. And all that's left is to put those two together. And E plus the S sound equals Ys, Maurice. I find that, I used to think I was pretty lucky on Rita Dove's part, but it looks pretty deliberate to me. And it's interesting to be able to track these rhymes and see how close they get, and how I feel as if she shows us at the level of sound how memory can work. You know, we stumble into what sounds like something, we think it begins with this letter, we're off by maybe two, but slowly the mind brings these sounds together, and this happens right in front of us in this poem. And then that final monostick of just Maurice in the last line. Why have the poem end that way? I guess in part because it's the moment of escape from the rumination and meditation towards memory. It's the moment of arrival at what we've been searching for. So it gets its own stanza. So, as I hope you can see, there should be a relationship between how a poem looks and what it's talking about. And I haven't added the number of lines in Rita Dove's poem, but I imagine they probably could be divided by two or three or something like that. That would look neater. And sometimes I think that neatness, I think it misleads us. And I think neatness can mislead us, and I think that is the possible danger of writing on a computer. But I know that might be a bit controversial. I know it can be generational, and there are those of us who have always written with a pen and piece of paper. That would be me. But I do know the temptation. Part of why I stick to writing that way is because once I actually throw something onto the computer, I start to get dissatisfied. It looked neat when I wrote it on paper because I was following my margins. But then I see that, oh, this line is actually a lot longer. There's a temptation to tuck things in. But I would argue that maybe more ragged endedness can be better, and that what's more important is to think about what is each section of your poem doing? Does it have movements? Are they even movements? Are they regular? And if not, then maybe the poem doesn't need to look regular. Neither of these poems does. And at the same time, it seems to me each of them has found the exact form it has to have.
So I hope you enjoyed hearing those poets speak about sound and shape and form in poetry. I know that for myself, sound especially is a very important part of what I do. Musicality, you know, I'm often thinking about trying to make something sound the way that I think that poem needs to sound to express what I hope to express in that piece of work.
It's so similar for me. In fact, I'm thinking that not long ago I was talking to a composer about how she composes classical pieces, and she said, well, I hear something over here, and then I hear something over here, and then eventually they come together, and that seems to be how poems get written from time to time.
Yeah.
Just a reminder, check out the writing assignments on the course website, join the discussions, post your poems in the forum. Enjoy.